From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There have been a wave of demonstrations across the country following a major U.S.-Israel attack on Iran, killing the country's supreme leader. Iran has since retaliated, and President Trump says the U.S. is prepared to continue attacks for weeks or longer, at a time when both countries were engaged in weeks of negotiations to prevent a conflict. California is home to the largest Iranian diaspora in the country, and many took to the streets over the weekend, including in Roseville and Turlock, with another demonstration planned in Sacramento tonight. We're going to look at this escalating conflict in the Middle East through a California lens with Sahar Razavi, the director of Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies at Sac State. Professor Razavi, thank you so much for taking the time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
As an Iranian American, what is top on your mind right now?
My first concern is for Iranians living inside Iran. We are not able to get a hold of our loved ones consistently. There are some blips of information coming out, text messages or phone calls, but I am very concerned about what is happening to people who are living in Iran right now.
I mean, as you are well aware, on Saturday, the U.S. and Israel launched airstrikes against Iran in broad daylight, which took the country and the world by surprise. The Ayatollah, other senior leaders were killed. Iran has since retaliated with its own attacks. And as of this morning, four U.S. soldiers have been killed. We're less than 72 hours into this conflict, and the word war is being used. Would you classify this as a war? Because there is a formal declaration of war, which did not happen. But that has also been the case with other conflicts, which have also been called a war. What is the threshold?
For me, it's pretty clear that it is a war. I think the hesitation on the part of the Trump administration to call it a war is because it's due to an awareness that this campaign is a violation both of United States and international law. And only Congress is empowered to declare war. And this is something that people were already discussing on Capitol Hill prior to these attacks. As far as international law is concerned, Israel itself has called this a preventative attack or preventative strikes. And under international law, preventative strikes are completely illegal. Preemptive attacks are permissible, but preemptive means by definition that there is an attack that is imminent that you need to thwart by attacking preemptively. No one from the United States or Israel has even attempted to make a case that there was an imminent attack coming from Iran. And as you know, Iran and the United States were in the midst of negotiations when the attack happened. The second time in a span of less than 9 months that an attack was launched against Iran by the United States and Israel while negotiations were taking place.
As someone with such a deep understanding of U.S.-Iranian relations, did this weekend's attack come as a surprise?
It did come as a surprise, to be honest. I did not necessarily think that the negotiations were going to produce a positive outcome or a significant resolution, but I was surprised that amid reports that the negotiations were going well, that suddenly a very serious bombing campaign was initiated.
Given that the airstrikes were in broad daylight, children were in school, people were at work, but it did end with the death of the supreme leader and also other top senior leadership. What do you make of the time that the attack, this happened? Was it justifiable?
It's hard for me to talk about it in terms of moral or ethical justification because as a political scientist, I think in terms of kind of intended and foreseeable consequences, and of course international law, and political and diplomatic ramifications. I mean, these are the kinds of questions that I have when I see attacks like this. An all-girls elementary school in Minab in southern Iran in Hormozgan was struck, and more than 100 girls ages 7 to 12 were killed along with their teachers. There are attacks on hospitals, on residential buildings, Abu Zar Hospital in Ahvaz, Semnon Street in Tehran, Sepahbud Street. I mean, there we have really disturbing videos coming out from Iran of people searching through rubble, of parents carrying their children with blood streaming down their faces. I mean, the ordinary civilians of Iran are the ones who are kind of at the forefront of my mind. And when I would like to answer the question of whether it's justifiable, but I really can't say. I feel like it's not my place to say, but I can tell you that it was a contravention of international law, and it also set a very troubling precedent to assassinate world leaders during peacetime, especially in the midst of negotiations, but even in the absence of negotiations. I'm concerned for what that may bring, knowing that Iran's military operational capacity is such that it could also carry out attacks, assassinating world leaders in the region. The precedent and the framework has been laid there for them, separate from whatever I may personally think about it.
Yeah, and you are among hundreds of thousands of Iranians living abroad. The United States is home to the largest diaspora of Iranians. California is home to the largest Iranian diaspora in the country. Why is California home to so many Iranians?
You know, it's a good question. I think Los Angeles was the primary anchor for a lot of people who were leaving Iran even before the revolution. In the 1960s and 70s, the late Shah was sending a lot of people abroad, students especially, to study. There are pockets of diaspora communities all across the country, major ones in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Houston, Urbana-Champaign, Oklahoma. There are a lot of New Jersey. There are a lot of areas where people were going that really are centered around either universities, or a lot of times people just had a couple of family members and they said, well, we might as well go to that place. And then it grew. We have a very high concentration of Iranians in LA, as you know, and many of them have been there since the 1979 revolution.
Why do some Iranians call themselves Persian?
You know, this really began in the 1980s after the revolution, and people at that time, there was a hostage crisis. There was a lot of hostility toward Iranians. People in my own extended family were being spit on and cursed at for just being Iranian. And so it was kind of natural for people to identify themselves publicly. A lot of them actually identified as Italian or other things, right? But for those who wanted to be forthcoming about where they were from, it was better for them to identify as Persian, to connect themselves in the public kind of public mind to the ancient civilization and empire of Persia, along with things that Americans like Persian rugs and Persian cats and things like that, rather than Iran, which is the name of the country. Persia is an exonym, meaning that it's been used by people outside the country, but Iran is the name that Iranians have used for the country. And I think, you know, it becomes complicated because people identify as Persian when Persian is the name of the language, but it's also an ethnicity in Iran. And you can be Iranian but not be Persian. Nevertheless, a lot of Iranians outside Iran identify as Persian because it feels more intuitively better to do so publicly.
The Supreme Leader had been in power for nearly 40 years. How significant is the killing of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei? I mean, does the weight of this compare to the Iranian Revolution in 1979?
It is very significant. The leadership role of Khamenei in the region, not only in Iran, but for Shias across the region, was very significant. And I think having said that, having recognized that he was the symbolic and political and, you know, practically, he was the head of the entire system. He was the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He was sort of the buck stops there in the office of the supreme leader for Iran. So that makes it, of course, extremely significant. At the same time, I don't think it's equivalent to the 1979 revolution because in the last 47 years, the Islamic Republic has built a political system that is very entrenched and is also has been responsive to and learned from conflicts in the region, including conflicts that it has been involved in, like the Iran-Iraq war, and has built a system that is kind of made to diffuse power enough that removing one person, even if it's the most important person in the system, is not necessarily going to lead to a collapse. The Iranian constitution has a system in place to trigger a succession plan in the event of the death of the supreme leader, and that is already happening. That said, it's very significant. There are not only because of his death, but a lot of the other top officials in the Islamic Republic. We have a moment right now of vulnerability for the Islamic Republic that Iranians themselves are, however else they may be feeling, by and large optimistic that there is a possibility for a fundamental transformation of the system, at the same time that many of them are, they wish that he could have been held accountable to the victims and the victims' families of the violence that he has foreseen over the last 37 years, and even before that in his other roles in the Islamic Republic. And some Iranians, though they are elated that he's gone personally, would have preferred that Iranians themselves had effectuated this change and not foreign powers from above.
As we've learned from you in the past, as recently as the start of the year when you joined us on Insight following countrywide protests in Iran and a violent and deadly crackdown by the government, the views of Iranians abroad and Iranian Americans can vary widely and can conflict with each other. They can even protest for widely different reasons. Overall, what has stood out to you about the demonstrations following these recent airstrikes and the supreme leader's death?
What I have seen has really driven home for me how much Iranian diaspora communities are disconnected from each other. There are some anti-war protesters who are very concerned about the possibility of not only war, but also territorial collapse for Iran. There are plans that have been published in the Jerusalem Post about Iran being cut up into several different pieces. There are other diaspora protests that are elated. You see singing and dancing, and while people are being pulled out of the rubble, there are people who are expressing a lot of joy and a lot of excitement. And those two groups are really disconnected from each other, aside from how connected or disconnected they may be from Iranians inside of Iran. That's kind of a different discussion. But for all the talk of the need for unity in the opposition, I'm not seeing a lot of efforts being made to actually bring about that unity.
I mean, let's focus on Iranians in Iran. You mentioned that, I mean, it's hard to get in contact with loved ones and people that you know. Have you been able to get a sense of how Iranians at home are feeling and faring in these initial days?
So the sporadic reports that I have gotten from loved ones inside of Iran range from being very scared to trying to make sure that we aren't worried about them here, to cautious optimism, to anger at the foreign intervention. I want to say here at the outset that according to not only my own personal anecdotes, which are very limited, very reliable public opinion data that we have from the last couple of years that was conducted by scholars in Europe and in the United States, even with the limitations they have, they are pretty reliable. The vast, vast majority of Iranians want a fundamental transformation to the system. They want regime change, but they differ on how exactly that should be brought about. They differ on the methods and the means by which to bring it about. So the reactions that I'm seeing from inside of Iran, from my own loved ones, are largely like everyone else, well, like almost everyone else, They are in favor of a change to the system, a fundamental change, but they are scared, some of them. A friend whose brothers live in Iran. They have said their houses are shaking amid the bombardment, and the kids are terrified. A cousin of my uncle is saying that they are okay for now, but they aren't sure what's going to happen next. I could list several more. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but there's a big mix of reactions.
Thank you for that. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sahar Rezavi, the Director of Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies at Sacramento State. For those who aren't part of the diaspora, how will Californians, Americans, feel the impact of this conflict or war the most? Will it be oil and gas?
So Iran announced that it had closed the Strait of Hormuz, and about 20% of oil, international shipments of oil go through the Strait of Hormuz. This is likely to have a pretty significant economic impact across the region and around the world. Just right before this segment, I was listening to the program that we haven't seen that spike yet. I anticipate that it will come, however. We also know that their regional allies have some impact, the Houthis in the Red Sea. There's a lot more that could happen. We also have more than one military base in California. We're going to have service members and their families who are impacted. I think war is very destabilizing, whether it's for the people on the receiving end of the attacks or the people launching the attacks. I think for the United States, the biggest consequences are going to be political for the Trump administration. I think he is calculating right now that being a wartime president is going to help him in the midterms. And he's very concerned about the GOP winning the midterms because he's afraid that if the Democratic Party wins a majority in Congress, that he will face another impeachment and possible removal this time. So he's very concerned to make sure that he is being kind of bolstered by all possible angles. If we see a prolonged war with a lot of casualties of U.S. service members, it could really backfire.
I'm curious, this is maybe a kind of out there question, but the airstrikes in Iran follow the U.S. also going to extreme surprise measures to capture Venezuela's leader. Right. So this is a tactic of the Trump administration. The airstrikes were from the United States and Israel, and there is still a war in Gaza. Are all of these isolated, or do you see some connections and parallels among these conflicts that are still unfolding?
They're definitely connected. One of Iran's strongest regional allies is Hezbollah in Lebanon. Since this began, Israel has renewed its bombings in southern Lebanon. We know that Gaza is still in rubble. I mean, we know that this is an ongoing crisis. There is a very long history that has been reported on by successive kind of generations of reporters on the Hill that Israel has been really angling to involve the United States in a war with Iran in order to weaken it for decades. So I think it would be naive of us to assume that they aren't connected. How exactly the sequence of events is going and which allies are saying what publicly as opposed to what they might be urging Trump to do privately, those are all things that we can't know for sure. I think we'll get trickles of reports. I think the fact that we're seeing Omani officials who were the mediators in this latest round of negotiations come out on doing media rounds saying that the negotiations were going very well. And in fact, Iran had basically agreed to nearly every concession that the United States had demanded. And then the bombing campaign began. I think this shows that some of the United States allies in the region are unhappy that they have initiated this war. And there has been very significant concern among Gulf Cooperation Council states of spillover across the region in the event of this war.
Do you also see a parallel with how the Trump administration captured Venezuela's leader?
I think they are very different cases, to be honest. Venezuela is a much smaller country, and it's a much different political system than Iran, and Iran's military is much different than Venezuela's military. So we might see more fundamental changes in Venezuela in the coming years. as a result of the abduction of Maduro, but I don't think, I mean, from the outset, the United States' objective in Iran has been regime change. And the military campaign has been much different than what we saw in Venezuela. So I think the parallels are few, but I think they're both rooted in a disregard for international law and a kind of broader approach to foreign relations that is very, I don't even know how to put it, does not value diplomacy. We can put it that way.
Finally, what would you like people here at home to keep in mind as this conflict continues to escalate?
My biggest concern is that Iranians don't get erased in the conversations, because Iran and the United States have been at odds politically for 47 years. We have a lot of national security narratives that are the focus of the conversation when there are really serious consequences for civilians. And that is the case not only in Iran, of course, but in other countries as well. But because Iranians have been discussed as a block for what kind of a threat they may pose or what kind of regional ambitions Iran might have, et cetera, I think that Iranian humanity gets lost. And the fact that we have a country of almost 100 million people plus several million outside the country often does not get the focus it deserves. War is going to bring a lot of suffering, even if the hopes and aspirations of many Iranians is realized about fundamental change. And I just hope we can keep Iranian humanity at the forefront of our minds as well.
Professor Razavi, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Sahar Razavi is the director of Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies at Sacramento State. Up next, we'll check in on how the rising cost of health insurance is affecting the budgets of Californians, 2 months after Congress failed to extend enhanced subsidies for the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.